Well, I'm... Thank you very much. It's certainly nice to be back in San Francisco again. In a way, it's almost like coming home because, as many of you know, I lived here for a little while and much longer in Carmel. And I believe that I made the acquaintance of more poets in San Francisco than in any other city where I've ever lived. Because when I was here, this was the city where, at my very first reading, in fact, on the coast, Charles Erskine Scott Wood and Sarah Bard Field were there. And Sarah Bard Field is in the audience tonight, one of our very finest poets, and a poet of whom you all, I'm sure, are very proud. And then I met here Marie Welch and Josephine Miles. And of course, you know, I am very grateful to San Francisco for starting recently the vogue of reading poetry to jazz. Kenneth Rexroth and Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Kenneth Patchen began that form of poetry reading out here a year or so ago, and it's since spread to the West Coast and seems to be spreading all over the country. And now a great many people seem to be disappointed when I come to read my poems that I don't have a jazz band with me. Well, the Poetry Center doesn't furnish jazz bands as yet, but maybe the next time. This also was the city of Noel Sullivan, who was one of the great patrons of the arts in all of America, and who helped many, many young people to begin their careers, and who, if you've read my second autobiography, I've written two so far, and I hope to write seven more. I hope to be like a cat, you know, with nine lives. I've only got two finished. If you read I Wonder as I Wander, in that book I try to pay tribute to your own Noel Sullivan, because it was he who helped me to begin to be a writer of prose. And my earliest short stories were done in the beach cottage of Noel Sullivan at Carmel, which he used to lend to writers, to artists, to singers, to painters when they wanted to work, a place where we could go and work without any expense or any worries or any cares. And I would like tonight to remember that very great patron of the arts, your own San Franciscan, Noel Sullivan. Well, tonight I'm going to read you my poems, and in reading them to you, I'm going to tell you how they came into being. In other words, I'm going to try to bring poetry down to earth, because, you know, here in our own country, a great many people seem to think that poetry has nothing to do with life. They think it's something way off up in the sky somewhere. Well, I don't agree with that concept about poetry at all. Poetry is an art, but I don't think it's an art in quotes, as a great many people seem to think it is. And in my own case, my poems have come right out of my very own life. They've come out of things I've done, places I've been, problems I've faced, people I've known. And so in reading them to you, I'm going to try to give you the background for them and show you how they came into being. And I'm going to start at the very beginning and tell you where I came into being. I was born in Joplin, Missouri, but I belonged to a family that was always moving. And I was supposed to have been born in Guthrie, Oklahoma, but it seemed that we moved about a week before I was born across the state line into Missouri, and so I was born in Joplin. And then, before I could even learn to remember my birthplace, we had moved all the way to Buffalo, New York. So I was told later, I don't remember Buffalo either. Then we moved to a town called Lawrence, Kansas. Well, that had been my mother's hometown in her youth, and it was in Lawrence, Kansas that I more or less grew up to the age of 13 or 14, because we moved a lot around the Middle West even then when I was a child. We weren't very stable, and we lived in towns like Colorado Springs and Concordia and Kansas City, Missouri. And as a child, I thought when I grew up, I'd like to be a streetcar conductor. Never dreamed about being a writer. I guess I wanted to be a conductor because almost all the towns where we lived had streetcar lines, several streetcar lines, and I never had enough nickels to ride to the end of all the car lines, so I thought if I were a conductor, I guess when I got grown, I could ride as much as I wanted to. But when I was going on 14, we moved to a town called Lincoln, Illinois, south of Chicago. And it was this family migration that changed the whole course of my life, because what happened in Lincoln caused me to eventually become a writer. We moved about the middle of October, I guess, and I was in the eighth grade, about to graduate from the grammar school. So I went into the new eighth grade graduating class in this new school in this new town of this class. The pupils were talking about holding a class election. It seemed that they'd heard that the high school graduating class had officers. They decided they wanted officers too. So this very first day of mine in this eighth grade class, the teacher was explaining to the pupils the qualifications for class officers, that a president had to know how to run a meeting, a secretary had at least to know how to write, and so on. And when she got onto the office of class poet, she stressed rhythm. She said a poet has to have rhythm. Well, on the way home from school, I walked along with the one other Negro pupil in the class, a girl, and she said to me, we don't need to worry about these old class elections. She said they never elect colored kids to anything in these schools. This is a prejudiced little town. Well, she was just about right. Lincoln was at that time the kind of town where if you were colored and wanted to go to the movies, you had to sit in the last row in the back on the left-hand side. That was the only place you could sit if you were colored, and if those six or eight seats were filled, then you couldn't get in the movies that night. Well, I didn't expect to be nominated for any class office because the children didn't even know me. I'd just come into the school. So I wasn't worried about the election, but I could vote. So the next day, when the election came off, sure enough, they had nominated and voted on all the officers, and the colored girl who'd been with this class through all the eighth grades wasn't nominated for anything. Nor was I. But when they got on to the very last office, the very bottom of the board, president, secretary, treasurer, sergeant-at-arms, everything had been elected but the class poet. When they got on there, there was a long pause. There weren't any nominations. Nobody said anything. Well, finally the teacher said, you do want a class poet, don't you? And everybody said, yes. And she said, well, you have to nominate, elect somebody. So the class looked around each other, and finally a little white boy got up and turned around and looked at me and called my name. And right away, the whole class said, I, unanimously, and that's the way I became a poet. I became a poet by unanimous acclamation in the eighth grade. Well, now, I didn't want to be class poet either. I wondered why in the world they made me class poet. But in thinking about it that night, I came to the conclusion that it must have been because, in speaking of poetry, the teacher stressed rhythm. And you know, there's a kind of conventional belief in our country, on the part of most white Americans, that all Negroes can sing and dance, and that all of us have a sense of rhythm. Well, now, I assure you, that's not 100% true. I happen to be one colored person that can't even carry a tune. I was excused from music all the way through high school because I threw everybody off key, and I can't dance very well either. But anyway, I suppose that thinking of class poet, rhythm, turning around and seeing me Negro, the three things must have been put together in the minds of those youngsters. And when my name was called, everybody said, I, and I became, at that moment, a poet. Well, I had all winter long to write my first poem. It turned out to be just about the longest poem I've ever written. It was 16 verses long. It's a wonder that anybody could sit through it, but when I read this poem at graduation in the springtime, the parents, the teachers, the pupils, everybody applauded very loudly, and I was so pleased by that, all that applause, that ever since then I've just kept right on writing poetry. So that's really the way I began. Well, the next year, and during the summer, we moved again. We moved to Cleveland, Ohio. In Cleveland, at Central High there, I found we had a very good high school magazine. But in looking through it every month, didn't see the names of a single Negro pupil writing for the magazine. Well, now, I've always had a lot of race pride, and I've always felt that Negro Americans should do everything that any other Americans do. And so I thought to myself, well, I'll try to write for this magazine. I'll write some poems. So I began to write little poems, sent them to the high school magazine. Every month they came right straight back to my homeroom. It wasn't prejudice, they just weren't good. But long toward the end of my first year in high school, one of my poems was accepted. And from that time on, I've been publishing poetry. I had a poem or a story or an essay or something in the high school magazine almost every month for the rest of my time in high school. My academic career is very much bound up with my early writing career, because the same thing happened in college. I wrote for my college papers and magazines. I was the class poet at graduation from high school. I was again a class poet in college. And so my writing career really began right in school. And I sort of got into professional writing, I guess, almost by accident. It wasn't until I was in college that I really thought about being a writer as such, that is, a writer trying to make a living. Well, I'll tell you about how I got to college, where I went. When I graduated from high school, my father lived in Mexico, and he sent for me to come down there to spend a year with him. And I took along with me to show him some of the poems I'd had published in my high school magazine. I think perhaps I should read you one or two of those before I go any further, so that you can see how I started out and what my early influences were. When I began to think of seriously writing poetry, I tried to write like Paul Ernst Dunbar on the one hand, and like Carl Sandburg on the other. Well, now, those of you who know Dunbar, you remember that he was a sort of singing, lyrical poet, a poet with a great deal of humor. He wrote in quaint Negro dialect of time. He died about the time that I was born, but when I was a child, the poems of Dunbar were in almost every Negro home. He was a very well-loved poet among the Negro people. And then, when I got to high school, I had not read very much poetry other than Dunbar, but we had the good fortune of having at Central High in Cleveland a teacher who liked modern poetry. Well, now, of course, that wouldn't be too unusual today to find a high school teacher who gives modern poetry to the students. But when I was in high school, it seemed that all the English teachers liked only poets who'd lived about 100 or 150 years before the pupils were born. And they would read to us, well, about the most recent poet that they would read to us from would be Longfellow. But usually it was Keats or Byron or somebody way back, even beyond, back to the Greeks and John Donne and so on. And it was beautiful poetry, but it had no connection with our own lives. But this particular teacher used to read to us from poets who were living, writing in our own time, who were fairly young then too. Poets like Edna St. Vincent Millay, like Edgar Lee Masters, like Carl Sandburg, and I particularly like Sandburg. So I tried to write in the singing lyrical style of Dunbar on the one hand in high school, and on the other hand in the free verse style of Carl Sandburg. It's a wonder I didn't fall completely between two stools. But I will read you now one of my very earliest poems, written when I was about 15, and you can see the Dunbar influence. It's a little Negro dialect poem called Dressed Up. It goes like this. I had my clothes cleaned, just like new. I put them on, but it still feels blue. I bought a new hat, sure is fine, but I wish I had back that old gal of mine. I got new shoes, they don't hurt my feet, but I ain't got nobody for to call me sweet. Pretty sad, that one, isn't it? Well, a year or two later, I wrote this poem in the Sandburg manner, and I think you can detect also in this poem an unconscious influence on my work at that time, unconscious on my part, of the Negro spirituals. There's a little refrain that sort of reflects the spirituals. This poem is about a girl who had come up from New Orleans in one of those migrations of Negro workers from the South to the North, and she came into our high school when I was a senior. And she used to walk down the hall very often in a red dress. And so I tried to describe her. The poem is called When Sue Wears Red, but her real name wasn't Sue. I was too shy in those days to put her name on the poem. But this is the way that she looked to me. When Susanna Jones wears red, her face is like an ancient cameo turned brown by the ages. Come with a blast of trumpets, Jesus. When Susanna Jones wears red, a queen from some time dead Egyptian night walks once again. Blow trumpets, Jesus. And the beauty of Susanna Jones in red burns in my heart a love fire, sharp like pain. Sweet silver trumpets, Jesus. That's the way I felt in those days every time I saw that girl. But she didn't marry me. She married somebody else no sooner than she got out of high school. And the last time that I went back to Cleveland a few years ago, I heard that she's been married four times since then. Well, when I got down to Mexico City, where my father lived, my early travels had been with my stepfather and my mother. My own father and my mother were divorced when I was 3 or 4 years old, and my father had gone away to Mexico because he didn't like the color line here in this country. He wanted to be a lawyer. It seemed that when he was a young man, there was no place where he lived that a Negro could study law. They wouldn't let you even go to a law school. So he took law by correspondence. When he was ready to try to pass the examinations for the state bar, it seemed that they wouldn't even let a Negro take the examinations for the bar. And curiously enough, you know, in Oklahoma, where my father lived shortly before I was born, it's just in the last half dozen years that a Negro citizen can go to law school in Oklahoma. So it took a long time to even begin to solve that problem. And there are still, I believe, one or two states in the Deep South where a Negro can't be a lawyer. Or you can be one, but you can't practice, so there's not much use being a lawyer if you can't practice at it. Well, my father practiced in Mexico City. He was a lawyer there for almost 30 years. And when I got down there, he had cut my career all out for me, had it all planned. He wanted me to be a mining engineer because he himself was then a lawyer for some mining firms, and he said that mining engineers were the people who were making all the money in Mexico. And he said, I'm going to send you to Switzerland to college because over there you can study mining engineering and you can learn three languages at the same time. And I said, well, why learn three languages at once? He said, well, so you can live in any part of the world you want to. You won't have to go back to the United States and fight prejudice. No sense in living there. So you go to Switzerland and learn French and German and what's the other one? Italian. It's a trilingual country, you know. And take mining engineering and you'll be all set for life. Well, I didn't want to be a mining engineer. I didn't want to learn three languages at once. And I didn't want to go to Europe either, oddly enough. I wanted to go to Harlem. I had begun to read... I had begun to read and hear a great deal about Harlem. I'd never been to New York. At that time, the young Duke Ellington, young Ethel Waters, young Paul Robeson were just coming to fame. And Harlem seemed like to me the cultural center of the Negro world. And I wanted to go there. Well, I knew if I told my father I wanted to go to Harlem, I'd never get near it because he had a great dislike for anything relating to Negroes and the color line and this country. He thought all Negroes were fools to live here. So I didn't tell him I wanted to go to Harlem, but I did tell him that I'd set my heart on going to college at Columbia University, and that Columbia certainly had very good schools, college classes that would lead to engineering school. Maybe I could go to Cornell and take engineering. And so I finally talked my father into letting me go to Columbia. He never did know why. Well, I came up to Columbia University, and to please him, I took subjects that would have led to engineering school if I had passed them, which I didn't. Trigonometry and chemistry and physics were very strange to me. I did quite well in French and English and sociology, but not the other things. So at the end of my freshman year, I wrote my father a letter, and I told him that I'd made up my mind to be a writer, and that if he didn't approve, he needn't send me any more money. Well, I soon learned that my father didn't approve, because he didn't send me another penny. And I found myself in New York City at the end of my first year in college with only $13. I had to move out of the dormitories on the campus, of course, when the freshman year was over. So I went down to Harlem. I found a room, $7.50 a week, for 1 week's rent. I learned right away that in the big cities with their segregated Negro ghettos, even colored landlords take advantage of the fact that Negroes can't live and rent all over town. And so they charge you $1 or $2 more than landlords do in any other part of town. Sometimes much more than that. They sometimes even double the rents, you know. And if you're colored, there's not much you can do about it. You haven't got the leeway of going somewhere else and finding a room or an apartment. Well, I knew I had to find a job right away. So I bought the morning papers very early in the morning, the old New York World and the New York Times. And there were a lot of ads. There wasn't any depression then. Ads for help wanted. And among them were whole columns of ads for office boys and filing clerks and so on. Well, now I thought with a high school education and a year of college that I might at least be an office boy. So that was the type of ad that I picked out to answer. I went down to Wall Street, Broad Street, way downtown, very early in the morning, into the offices, and in every single office I was turned down. Usually politely, evasively, "We don't need anybody," or "The position's been filled," or "There must be some mistake, we didn't advertise." But in some offices, quite frankly, I would be told, "We don't hire Negroes, no colored people work here, we don't have a porter job today." And so I began to find out on the very first day that I set out in the world to earn my own living in New York City, one of the most liberal cities in the country even then, that there was a very definite color line in labor. That there were just thousands of quite ordinary jobs that if you were white, you could at least apply for and nobody would be astonished. But if you were colored, they were surprised. Well, now, I'm happy to say that that condition has changed greatly in our major northern and western cities. In New York City today, it is no longer a novelty to see a Negro office boy or a Negro stenographer in an office. But then it was. Then you never saw a colored girl clerk in any of the big department stores. But fortunately, since the war particularly, the color line has broken down in many of those, quite common occupations. And today you see Negro girls behind the counters in Saks Fifth Avenue, or in Lord & Taylor's, or Macy's, or Gimbel's. And the same thing is true in Chicago and Detroit, and I hope it is true here in San Francisco, I don't know. But certainly the major northern cities, the color line has begun to disappear in the more or less common occupations, you know. But when I was looking for work in New York some 30 years ago, almost the only thing that a Negro boy could find to do, a young man, was work like busboy or waiter or porter or red cap. And so I wrote a number of poems about the color line in labor. And I think these poems are still valid for most of our country today, because you take a city like Omaha, Nebraska, for example, and you walk down the main street in Omaha, and you never see a colored clerk in the shop. Yet Negroes trade in the shops. You go in the bank, you never see a Negro teller or bookkeeper. You go to the telephone exchange to see how the big switchboards work. No colored girls getting numbers. And so I think this poem, Elevator Boy, is true for most of our country now. It goes like this. "I got a job running an elevator in the Denison Hotel in Jersey. Job ain't no good, though. No money around. Jobs are just chances like everything else. Maybe a little luck now, maybe not. Maybe a good job sometimes. Step out of the barrel, boy. 2 new suits and a lot of money. Maybe no luck for a long time. Only the elevators going up and down, up and down. Or somebody else's shoes to shine. Or greasy pots in a dirty kitchen. I've been running this elevator too long. I guess I'll quit now." And so the boy quits and goes and gets a job running an elevator somewhere else, but at least he has a change of scenery. What I'm trying to say on this point, I think, is that those kinds of dead-end jobs that don't lead anywhere don't lead one to have very much ambition either. And so no wonder many young Negroes have sort of given up and haven't tried very hard. Well, I decided that if I had to work for low wages, long hours, dull kinds of work, I'd just as well get on the boats and see the world. I knew they didn't pay very much on the ships then, but nevertheless, I went down to the docks, and after 2 or 3 weeks of searching, I got a job on a boat going, of all places, to Africa. And that trip to Africa was like the dream trip of my life. I'd always wanted to see the motherland of the Negro people. Never hoped to get that far away. I found myself working on a boat going to Africa. We went all up and down the West Coast. We went to Dakar, down to the Congo River, Niger River, and way up the Niger, and then almost down to Cape Town. And so I had a chance to see all of one whole side of the so-called Dark Continent. And that trip had a very great influence on my thinking and on my work. For one thing, it gave me a new feeling of pride in my own racial background. When I was a child, in the geographies in Kansas and Missouri, Africans were always pictured as frightful, savage, bushy-headed people, you know, and I was almost afraid I'd be afraid of the Africans when I got over there. Well, I'm glad to say that that picturing of the primitive peoples has largely disappeared from our textbooks, and there have been many changes, you know, for the better in race relations in many ways, and that is one of them. Primitives are no longer pictured in their worst and most frightful aspects anymore to children. And when I got to Africa, I found that the Africans were no more savage than we are here. And they were just as polite, as kind of people. They were hospitable, intelligent. Those who could speak English were interested in world problems. They even knew about Harlem, many of them. And if they couldn't speak English, they would get somebody to interpret and ask you very intelligent questions. And even way up the Congo River, where they didn't wear any clothes at all, hardly, they nevertheless were not savage people who received you in a frightful and scary way or wanted to harm you. And so, when I came back, I had this new and real concept of what the Africans were. And I found them a very beautiful and handsome and clean people physically. And so I wrote poems about them. I'll read you only one of the most brief of the poems that came out of that trip. This one called My People. The night is beautiful, so the faces of my people. The stars are beautiful, so the eyes of my people. Beautiful also is the sun. Beautiful also are the souls of my people. Another thing that I learned in Africa, which has come out in many ways in my work, was that the so-called color problem is certainly not a problem that just we here in the United States have. And techniques of oppressing people, well, there were some techniques used in Africa that even the people in Mississippi haven't thought of here, I don't believe. I found many things in common over there with the American Negro problem. For example, I saw signs up in the very first ports that our ship went into, outside restaurants, theaters, and other public places, Europeans only. And I soon learned that those signs meant white only. Well, we've had those signs in our country. I found out that there were even churches, missionary churches, in some of the African colonies, where the white people who were bringing Christianity to the natives all sat in front of a brass rail, and the African people themselves were segregated behind a brass rail, right in church. Well, I learned what the term colonial and colonial problem meant. And I learned that every port to which our ship went belonged not to the Africans themselves, but to the British or the French or the Dutch or the Portuguese, or the Belgians. And so I wanted to see this Europe that controlled Africa. And when I came back to the States, I got a job on a boat going to Europe, running over to Rotterdam. Well, I will tell you just a little bit about that trip and read you one or two sea poems. This trip to Rotterdam was made in the middle of the winter, and my African trip had been in comparatively calm seas. The ocean hadn't gotten too rough by the time we got back. But the first trip to Rotterdam took 17 days. Should have taken only 10 on a rusty old freight boat. And the second trip over took 22 days in the middle of a great storm most of the time. Well, I tried to describe something of the feeling of the ocean when you get out in the middle of the ocean and you haven't seen the land for days, in a poem called Long Trip. The sea is a wilderness of waves, a desert of water. We dip and dive, rise and roll, hide and are hidden on the sea. Day, night, night, day, the sea is a desert of waves, a wilderness of water. And when you're working on a very small boat, the waves oftentimes seem twice as high at least as the boat, and I'm sure sometimes they are. One of these gigantic waves swept over this boat one day and smashed all of the lifeboats on one side, and we were still about 15 days off the English Channel. Well, a day or two later, one of the mess boys was severely scalded in a storm, a pot of soup overturned in the galley. If you wanted to be sure of being in your bunk in the morning, sometimes you had to tie yourself in. The ship rocked and rolled so. And I had bought myself a new suit in New York, and I was so proud of a new suit, I hadn't had one in about 2 years, that I put it on a hanger and took a sheet and put over it to keep the dust off of it and hung it up against the wall in my bunk room. Well, this suit swung like that against the bulkhead all the way across the Atlantic. Every time the boat would rock, for 22 days the suit swung. When I got to Rotterdam and took my new suit down to go ashore, there was no back in the coat at all. It was all worn out just from swinging. So that will indicate to you what a rough trip this was. Well, the final tragedies, or rather there were two really, caused me to think maybe there was a jinx on this boat and I'd better get off. What happened about a week out from the European shore was that our wireless man lost his mind. We had no use of the radio in mid-ocean. And then one of our chief officers got pneumonia, became seriously ill. There are no doctors, you know, on cargo ships, American cargo ships, that is. And if you get very ill, there's nothing much to do but go ahead on and die, and this man died. I saw my first funeral at sea. They wrapped his body up in canvas, put it on a board, and covered him with the American flag. The chief mate said a few words over the body, and then they pushed the board up to the edge of the ship and lifted it up and let the body slide off into the sea. But they very carefully hold on to the flag and fold it up and put it away for the next funeral. When we finally got to Rotterdam, I decided that I would get off this boat and go see Paris. I wanted to see Paris anyhow. You can draw half your money in a foreign port, you know. I had $50 coming, but I could only draw $25. So I drew my $25 and bought a ticket to Paris and had to pay $10 or $12 or so for various papers and visas and so on. And when I got to Paris, I had only $7 left. I wasn't worried, though. I didn't know a soul in all of Europe, but I was sure that I knew French quite well because I'd had 3 years in high school and a year in college. And so I didn't think I'd have any trouble finding a job in Paris with the French that I had at my command. But I learned right away that very first morning in the station that my French didn't work very well. I went up to the counter to order some breakfast in the Gare du Nord, and I said, Donnez-moi des oufs, s'il vous plaît, du jambon. They looked at me. Nobody moved to give me anything. Well, I was trying to order ham and eggs, and I would have thought they would understand the words ham and eggs, even though I learned later the French people don't even eat ham and eggs for breakfast. So I repeated, des oufs, s'il vous plaît, du jambon. Still didn't get a thing, but I saw the coffee urn bubbling over in the corner and some nice rolls right in front of me. So I pointed at the coffee urn, I pointed at the rolls, and right away I got coffee and rolls. So I learned that you don't really have to know a foreign language in a foreign country to get essentials if you just know sign language. It'll work all right. But you can't get a job with sign language, at least I couldn't. And so for almost a month I lived on coffee and rolls, or rather I should say coffee and a roll per meal, because I didn't have enough money to eat any more. And finally I found a job as a doorman in a nightclub without salary. One's tips were to constitute the income, but you got your dinner and your supper at midnight. And so I thought this was quite wonderful, to get a job where you got a dinner. So I went to work in this nightclub, and it turned out to be a very tough little nightclub. I didn't know they had gangster nightclubs in Paris before, but they do. And this was a sort of underworld nightclub, frequented largely by Central Europeans and Turks and people from Asia Minor, and they used to fight a great deal inside this club, and when they fought in maybe a dozen different languages at once. And it turned out that I was supposed to be not only the doorman, but the bouncer, and throw people out. And they got to fighting. Well, I didn't stay there very long. I heard that they wanted a second cook in the Grand Duke. So I went down to the Grand Duke, and when they asked me could I cook, I said, oh, yes, I can cook. I really couldn't. But it turned out, fortunately for me, that the title second cook was purely honorary. It really meant dishwasher and pot washer. So I could hold the job. And I took the job and worked in the kitchen of the Grand Duke for almost 7 months. Well, now, I expect many of you have known the Grand Duke because it got to be quite a famous nightclub in Paris. Later, Bricktop was the hostess there. And at the time that I was there, they had a wonderful Negro jazz band from New York. Working in the kitchen of the Grand Duke, every night I used to hear this jazz band playing. And the beat of this jazz music sort of got into my blood, and I began to try to reproduce it in poetry. And it was the jazz poems that I began to write at this time that led to my being a professional writer, because these were the first poems that I sold. And so I'd like to read you one of them. Now, I'll read you one that will date the period for you, those of you who are old enough. For the students, if you're not old enough to remember the Charleston, I think most young people would hardly have ever seen it, you ask some of your teachers out at San Francisco State to show it to you, because when they were young, the Charleston was a dance that was going around almost like hula hoops have been going around lately, you know? It swept the whole country, and then it went around the world. I don't believe we've had a dance craze like the Charleston since. And so I tried to get something of the Charleston beat into this poem, Negro Dancers. Me and my baby's got two more ways to do the Charleston. Da, 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 da. Two more ways to do the Charleston. Soft light on the tables, music gay, brown-skinned steppers in a cabaret. White folks laugh, white folks pray, 'cause me and my baby's got two more ways to do the Charleston. Well, it was Josephine Baker, you know, who brought the Charleston to Paris in a big way. And Josephine, who came during the time that I was there, became the most famous star in all of Europe and held that position for almost 20 years. Well, I didn't have a very hard time once I got a job in Paris, but I didn't make very much money. However, I did manage to save enough to go on a vacation when the place closed up in August, as everything does in Paris. And you can travel very cheaply in Europe, you know. For less than $9, I was able to buy a ticket all the way to Venice. I was always wanted to see if Venice really had streets of water. So I went down there to see. And when I got there, I found out it does have streets of water. It is the picture book city that you read about and dream about. And I stayed in Venice for almost a month and had a wonderful time. Then I got on the train, starting back to Paris to get my job back in September when the place reopened on the Rue Pigalle. I went to sleep in this very crowded third-class coach. I pinned my passport and my money up inside of my coat pocket here with a safety pin, the way I'd been taught to travel as a little boy in Kansas, and I thought it was quite safe, so I slept soundly away in this crowded third-class coach coming across northern Italy. And when I woke up, the safety pin, my passport, everything in the pocket was gone. Well, I couldn't go into France without a passport. Couldn't go any further than Genoa anyway with no money. So I went to the American consul in Genoa and I told him what had happened. And he was a very kind, considerate man, believed my story. And he didn't have to identify me as an American or give me a paper that would let me get back home. But he did. He gave me what would amount to, I guess, a temporary passport. But he said, the government doesn't give us any money to help stranded travelers, so this is the only thing I can do for you. But I suggest that you go down to the docks and try to get a job on a boat to work your way home. Well, I did. But even way over there in Italy, our American color line stretched out in relation to American ships, because boat after boat from this country came into the harbor, going to the Black Sea, going to Asia Minor, going to Turkey, some of them going around the world. Wouldn't take a Negro on the crew. I had to wait until a ship came along that already had some Negroes in the crew to be even considered to work on the boat. Well, meanwhile, I live in a place where the council sent me, where he told me you could live for only a few cents a day, and it turned out to be the municipal flop house of Genoa. But it was a nice, clean flop house. It had been built by Mussolini, and it was very well run. So that's where I slept. And finally, a boat came into the harbor that would sign me on as a workaway, so I worked my way back to New York. Well, on the way across the ocean, I washed a shirt for the first mate, and he gave me a quarter. So I got back home with a quarter. I told you I arrived in Paris with $7. My first European tour, which had included France, Italy, Spain on the way home, Lipari, the Canary Islands, Gibraltar, a real grand tour. My first European tour really cost me only $6.75. So you see, it's not expensive to travel if you don't mind working your way around. Well, I tell you all these things because these are the things that furnish the background for my poetry that helped to give me the outlook that you will discern in most of my writing. Well, going from the rhythms of jazz, which intrigued me in Paris, of all places, and which caused me to take a serious interest in the roots of jazz, caused me to go backwards in sort of, you know, inversely into the folk rhythms from which jazz comes. And so when I got back home, I began to be sort of seriously interested in trying to write poems in the manner of the blues and the spirituals. Now, I had heard the spirituals and the blues all my life, but without paying any attention to them really or realizing their value. In Kansas City, when I was a child, you heard blues all the time. When I got back home, I went to live in Washington, hoping to go to Howard University, and I got a job in the Wardman Park Hotel there as a busboy, and I used to write blues. And one of my blues won a prize, or rather a poem about the blues, a poem called The Weary Blues, which incorporated actual blues verses, won the Opportunity Prize. Our Negro magazine of the Urban League had a contest, and I got the first prize. Well, they wanted me to come to New York to get the prize. It was $50, and so I spent my prize going after it, and the money didn't really benefit me any, but the resulting publicity did. And then along about that time, another thing happened, which, in a sense, began my publicized career, I guess you might say, that and the prize together. One day, into the dining room of the Wardman Park Hotel in Washington, came the great poet Vachel Lindsay at lunchtime. I knew that Vachel Lindsay was going to read his poems that night in the little theater of the hotel, and I wanted to hear him read his poems, but I knew I couldn't go, because in Washington then, colored people couldn't go to any public places, theaters and so on, outside the Negro districts. You know, it's only been in the last few years that colored people can see a play right in the national capital, downtown. Well, I'm glad to say that's changed. I guess I could go into the theater of the Wardman Park Hotel now if I lived in Washington. But then I couldn't. Well, I could at least look at Vachel Lindsay sitting at the table, and I thought to myself, I'll give him some of my poems to read since I can't hear him read his. So I went into the pantry, and I very quickly wrote down on some slips of paper that I found there, three of my poems, including The Weary Blues. And I put them down beside Vachel Lindsay's plate where he was dining all alone, and I said rather shyly, because I was afraid of celebrities in those days, in fact, I still am afraid of celebrities, I said, well, I try to write poetry, I certainly like yours, or something like that, and here's some of mine, and went away. Never saw Vachel Lindsay again. But the next morning, when I went to work, about 7 o'clock in the morning, out in the kitchen, the head waiter said to me, there are reporters and cameramen waiting for you inside the dining room. You're Hughes, aren't you? And I said, yes. He said, well, they're waiting for you in there. I said, for me? What have I done? He said, well, I don't know, but they want to see you. So I quickly got into my uniform and went into the dining room, and sure enough, there were three or four reporters and a cameraman, and they said, you're Langston Hughes? And I said, yes. And they said, you've been discovered. I didn't know what they meant quite, so I asked them, what did they mean? And they said, well, don't you know that last night Vachel Lindsay read your poems to his audience, including senators and ambassadors, and there was a great deal of applause, and he says that you are a very promising young poet right here in Washington, and you're discovered, and we want to take your picture, and we want to interview you, and get over there and pose. And so I picked up a tray of dirty dishes from somebody's breakfast, and with this tray up like that, they took my picture in the middle of the Warden Park Hotel dining room. That was my first publicity photo. That picture was syndicated by the United Press and sent all over the country, as was one of the interviews. And that and the Opportunity Prize together, which occurred about the same time, was the beginning, really, of my publishing career, because as a result of these incidents, Alfred Akerknoff wrote me and asked me about the poem The Weary Blues, and asked me if I had enough poems to make a book, and I did. Poets always have more than enough poems to make a book. I have enough now to make 6 books that are, you know, are unpublished. So I sent my poems to Akerknoff, and they were accepted. They were given the title The Weary Blues, and that was my first book. It came out in 1926. Well, out of this also came a scholarship to go to college. I went through college on my poetry. I went through Lincoln University my last 3 years, graduated from there in 1929, and ever since that time, I've been making my living from writing. I haven't had a job since the Warden Park. I've tried to find them, but you know, the Depression came along about the time I graduated from college. And fortunately, my first novel was ready to be published by that time, Not Without Laughter, which I wrote in college, by the way. They let me stay on the campus one summer and finish it when nobody else was in the dormitory. And so, ever since that time, I've been what you might call a professional writer. Well, now, in closing, I'd like to read you 2 or 3 poems in the folk manner, and then 2 or 3 of my shorter poems about the race problem. I told you that I'd heard the blues as a child. Well, I didn't realize how beautiful the real folk blues are at that time. I think the beauty of the spirituals, being more obvious, more people appreciate. But for a very long time, you know, people looked down on blues as being low class anyway and disreputable. Well, I think the blues are just as beautiful in their way as the spirituals. And I think most people who appreciate folklore now feel the same way. But 20 years, 25 years ago, they didn't. Well, the blues, you know, are highly interesting songs. They're songs with a strict poetic form. I'm talking about the real folk blues now, not the Broadway blues. And it's a very simple form, but nevertheless it's strict. It's a long lyric line repeated, a third line that rhymes with the first two. And musically, it's usually the 12-bar blues, you know, sometimes 16 bars. And then a difference between the blues and the spirituals, another, is that the blues are individual songs. They're sung by one man, one woman alone, whereas the spirituals are group songs. The blues can be sort of divided by sex, too, insofar as subject matter goes, because they're men's blues and they're women's blues, and the men's blues are usually economic. They're usually blues about work, or else being out of work, or how hard work is, or how hard work is to find, or being a long ways from home and no money to get back. And the women's blues are usually about love. Women almost always sing about some man that they love, very often about some man who's gone away and left them before she's ready for him to go. I would like to read you one blues. I'll read you a man's blues. I'll read you one called Out of Work. And you can tell what period it's from because it mentions the WPA. In other words, it's a depression blues. It goes like this. I walked the streets till the shoes were off my feet. I done walked the streets till the shoes were off my feet. Been looking for a job so that I could eat. I couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. Couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. WPA man told me, you got to live here a year and a day. A year and a day, Lord, in this great big lonesome town. A year and a day in this great big lonesome town. I might starve for a year, but that extra day would get me down. Well, you see, I think it's that quality of sadness and humor in the blues that has been transferred to American jazz that makes our jazz music really unique in the world. I think maybe that's the quality that makes people love jazz all around the world, a combination of sadness and of humor. Because popular music in most other countries is one thing or the other. It's all gay and happy and jolly, or it's all sad. But our popular music combines the two qualities, and I think it gets it from the blues. Well, I'd like to read you a poem in the manner of the spirituals, or two. I have written many such poems, and lately I have written in the latest, or the newest of the Negro folk manners, because it's a recent development, really. Spirituals, you know, are no longer created. I think it's a folk form that is of the past entirely now. But the offshoot of the spirituals is the gospel song. And those of you who haven't heard the gospel song other than through Mahalia Jackson at least know what it is, because she has made it famous on television and in concert halls. But the gospel song is a written spiritual, a created spiritual. It's not an anonymous, purely folk thing, but it's so near the folk style, and it's written by people who come right out of the folk, that I think the gospel song and the singing in the gospel churches today is perhaps the last refuge of Negro folk music, of uncontaminated Negro folk music. Because the blues, you know, have been Broadwayized and rock and rollized and distorted, and the spirituals have been concertized and overarranged and changed about a great deal. But the gospel song is a, to my mind, a pure contemporary Negro folk form. And so I have lately been trying to write lyrics in the style of the gospel song. But these, in the manner of the spirituals, precede by a long ways my contemporary gospel lyrics. This is a poem called Judgment Day in the style of the spirituals. They put my body in the ground. My soul went flying o'er the town. Lord Jesus. Went flying to the stars and moon, a-shouting, God, I's coming soon, O Jesus. Lord in heaven, crown on his head, says, don't be afraid, 'cause you ain't dead, kind Jesus. And now I'm setting clean and bright in the sweet of my Lord's sight, clean and bright, clean and bright. And I'd like to read you my favorite poem of that group, a poem that came out of an incident in my childhood in a little church in Lawrence, Kansas, where I went as a little boy. There was a very old lady who used to come to church regularly every Sunday morning, very neat and clean, but dressed very quaintly. She probably hadn't bought any new clothes for 20 or 25 years, and so she wore shirts with staves in the collar, you know, shirt waist that went way up under her chin, and wide skirts with flounces around the bottom. And sometimes when she went down the aisle of this little church on Sunday morning, some of the younger people, teenagers usually, would be inclined to giggle a little bit about this old lady and whisper as she went down the aisle. And one day she must have overheard some young people say something that she didn't like or hurt her feelings, so she turned around the aisle of the church and she looked at them and said, that's all right, y'all are all dressed up, y'all look mighty fine back there, but you don't need to be laughing at me, you don't need to be stuck up, my Lord ain't stuck up. And with that she went on down to her seat in the Amen corner. Well, that line, my Lord ain't stuck up, must have remained in my subconscious a great many years, and a long time afterwards it came out in this poem called My Lord. My Lord ain't no stuck-up man. My Lord, he ain't proud. When he goes a-walking, he gives me his hand. You, my friend, he loud. My Lord knowed what it was to work. He knowed how to pray. My Lord's life was trouble too, trouble every day. My Lord ain't no stuck-up man, he's a friend of mine. When he went to heaven, his soul on fire, he told me I was gwine. He said, sure, you'll be with me and be my friend through eternity. Well, in my latest book, which came out about 10 days ago, a novel called Tambourines to Glory, there's a character something like this old lady that I knew in my childhood, because this new book of mine is about the gospel churches in New York City, the storefront churches. I have been called many different kinds of poets in my time. A long time ago, when my first book came out, one critic called me a documentary poet. A little bit later on, another critic termed me a social poet.
After a while, somebody called me a propaganda poet, and a lot of people seemed to like that term for various reasons, and so I was called a propaganda poet for a long time, and sometimes it wasn't meant very kindly. And recently I've been called a folk poet. Well, I don't know. I consider myself not a very personal poet. I think maybe the description social poet suits me best, because what I really do feel is that in very often expressing my own self and the problems that I myself know and face, being a Negro, I therefore express the problems of a great many other people of my own group in this country. Not of everybody, because Negroes vary as much as any other kinds of people do, and our problems vary very greatly. That is one of the things that I try to show in this next poem that I'm going to read to you, that the so-called race problem is certainly, it might seem simple on the surface, but it's very complex underneath. And to colored people themselves, oftentimes, the problem is very puzzling. Traveling as I do all over the country, I early learned that you can never know quite what to expect if you're colored, no matter where you might be. In New York City now, for example, I would say that a colored person there is almost never faced directly, bam, with the color problem from day to day. And yet, not too long ago, I went into a hotel. I was going to a meeting of a professional organization to which I belong, ASCAP, to tell the truth. And other ASCAP members were going in up the elevators. Nobody was saying anything. But when I went to get in the elevator, the starter asked me, "Are you delivering something?" And I was all dressed up in my very best blue suit. But just the very fact that I was colored must be a delivery man. And I said, "No, I'm not delivering anything. I'm going to the ASCAP meeting." "Oh, well, you know." Then you go a little ways outside of New York. Don't have to go very far. Go right across to New Jersey, across the river. And you might want a cup of coffee and a hamburger, and you can't get it. You sit on the stool in a diner, the man will pay you no attention, or he won't serve you. You go a little bit farther. Say you go to Baltimore, which is about 2 hours from New York. And in Baltimore, you know, there's a real color line. Baltimore's in the south already. And you go a little bit farther across the Potomac, just across from Washington, dead within the sight of the dome of the Capitol, and what happens? If you're colored, you can't send your children to school anywhere. Have to go to the segregated schools. You can't ride in the buses without sitting on the back seat. And then you go a little bit further on, down in the deep south, and you might step off the train, and somebody might object to you being on the sidewalk. If you don't step off, you might be put in jail, or you might be physically injured. And so that's the way our color problem runs, all those kinds of variations. Well, this poem, called Merry-Go-Round, is about a little girl, I imagine 6 or 7 years old, who was puzzled by all these things. In her way, I imagine this little girl came up from the south with her parents, who perhaps came to work in the airplane plants in Los Angeles, maybe, or they might have come on up to Oakland, or they might have come to a city like Minneapolis, or maybe Newark, New Jersey. Anyway, in this northern or western city, this little girl goes to a carnival, little colored girl. She sees a merry-go-round going around. She wants to ride, but remembering the South where she grew up, how you're segregated down there and put on the back seats and Jim Crow cars and so on, and how a lot of things you can't do at all, the little girl doesn't know whether she can ride on this merry-go-round or not, and if she can ride, she doesn't know where. And so at this carnival, let's imagine a carnival in San Jose, you know? At this carnival, this little girl looks at the merry-go-round, and this is what she says to the man. "Where is the Jim Crow section on this merry-go-round, mister? 'Cause I want to ride. Down south where I come from, white and colored can't sit side by side. Down south on the train, there's a Jim Crow car. On the bus, we're put in the back. But there ain't no back to a merry-go-round. Where's a horse for a kid that's black?" Well, of course, I feel that our country is big enough and rich enough to have a horse for every kid. I think eventually we will. Right at the moment, you know, we read about the bombings of churches and schools and synagogues in the Deep South. And we read about Little Rock and people who don't know, who live in other countries, think that that represents the whole of our America in relation to the Negro people. But of course, those of you who live here in San Francisco, or those of us who live in a city like New York, know that Little Rock doesn't by any means represent our country. And those of us who've lived as long as I have know that there have been a great many changes for the good, particularly since the last World War. We know that there are a great many white friends of democracy who don't like color lines and Jim Crowisms and separate schools and people like Phobos. And we know that those friends are helping to make our country what we Negro people certainly hope it will become in relation to ourselves. But white friends of democracy are not new at all. In fact, way back in slavery time, a great many white people didn't believe in slavery. A great many white people helped slaves to escape. The Underground Railway, the Quakers, John Brown, all the people who helped way before the Civil War. And then all throughout the Reconstruction, if there hadn't been whites who went into the Deep South, set up schools for colored people, at the risk of their lives, sometimes the schools were burned, the teachers stoned, some of them even killed. But if it hadn't been for those teachers, there wouldn't have been any Negroes who could read or write for a very, very long time. In fact, some of my own grandparents owe their education to the white abolitionists who went into the South after the war and helped to educate the Negro people. And so my feeling is that in our country, with all of its problems, there is enough democratic strength, enough goodwill for us to pull through even the worst of these problems, for us even to help a state like Mississippi or Arkansas solve its problems. And so, in closing, I want to read you two poems of hope. One is called Youth, and the other is called I Too. They're very old poems of mine, but until we do solve these problems, these poems will still be valid, I think. The one called I Too goes like this. I Too Sing America. I'm the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am America. And of course, I think an audience like this, everyone in it would know of some of the beauties that the Negro people have given America. I've tried to point out in my reading the beauties that have come from Negro folklore and Negro folk songs and the happy gift of jazz music that comes out of the African drums that the slaves brought over with them. But so many people for so long thought of Negroes only as musicians and dancers and singers that I myself have tried to rectify that concept. And in recent years, I've written a number of books for young people in which I've tried to put forward the many other things that Negroes have done. The last of my books in that series is called Famous Negro Heroes. A great many people don't know that a large portion of the Southwest was opened up to European settlement by a Negro explorer, Estevan Nico, way back in the 15th century. An African came over with the Spaniards and came up from Mexico City with an exploring party and was the first non-Indian to enter what is now New Mexico and Arizona. A great many people don't know that the first man to stand on the North Pole was Matt Hansen, who went to the pole with Perry, and he was a runner for Perry, and he was sent ahead, you see, with the dogs and the supplies, and I think Hansen got to the pole 45 minutes before Perry did, and Perry gave him the honor of planting the American flag on the North Pole. There are Negro inventors, Negro scientists. Well, there's so many things that one can name. This is not the place to do it. But I'm simply saying that Negroes, too, have contributed very, very greatly to the whole civilization and culture of America, are so much a part of America that, in the opinion of the Negro people, we should not be denied any of the rights and privileges.